Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSTL 90.7 FM, Ocean City, Delmarva Public Radio. We take you now to Salisbury University's Research Day and Innovation Showcase. This was recorded Friday, September 27th, 2013. This is the first of two broadcasts from this event. Salisbury University's inaugural Research Day and Innovation Showcase highlighted current faculty endeavors and provided information about the various efforts connecting the university and the community. Participants learned how they could connect with the university's faculty, staff, and programs to help form solutions to strengthen our community. For more information on this event, please visit the website salisbury.edu/researchday.
Our first presenters are Dr. Michelle Slayhofer, Associate Professor from Psychology, and Dr. Chris Egan, Associate Prof, Communication Arts.
Thank you. Hello. It's good to be here today. We're happy to kick off our session today with the first presentation. I'm Michelle Slayhofer. I'm in the Psychology Department.
And I'm Chris Egan from Communication Arts.
And we're going to talk today about the process and benefits of conducting applied community-based research. And we want to actually start here with our university mission statement. So as we were planning our talk, we did a lot of reflecting about what are the goals and mission of the university. And I have just part, obviously, of our mission statement here, connecting what we learn to how we live. And I just want everyone to keep that in mind as we proceed forth today. I know that usually when we hear this, we think about our students. And obviously, we want our students to connect their classroom-based learning with things that they're doing, how they're living their lives. However, this actually really embodies the purpose of community-based research, right? Connecting, learning, and living, okay? So what do I mean when I say community-based research? Well, community-based research is a combination of university-situated knowledge with that of the community, of community-based organizations, and of community members. It's research that's collaborative, that's conducted with, by, and for community organizations and community members. And it's usually revolved around addressing some type of social problem or community need. Okay, so there's something going on in our community, we want to try to help fix that problem, and we're going to work together in a collaborative fashion to meet those community needs. To give you an example of what this type of research looks like, we have just a few examples, and we'll just briefly talk about these various projects just to illustrate some of the diversity that these types of projects have. The first up here, the Course Service Agency project, is one that I conducted a few months ago, in which I served as a consultant for the Course Service Agency. I conducted focus groups and interviews with people in the community who are involved in providing services for foster care children. The Wicomico Partnership Project is one that both Chris and I have been involved in for a little over a year now. That's involved doing a quantitative survey of community members out in Wicomico County of their perceptions of programs and resources for families and children. That's been a longer project. It's been interdisciplinary, and it's involved students as doing work for, as serving as a research assistant in various classes in communication arts, in psychology, and through the Institute for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement.
The Holly Community Caregiver Study also involved focus groups with caregivers of people with disabilities to evaluate those particular services. And then most unique was probably the Salisbury Zoo Study, which started off with surveys, and those were used to create a public relations campaign targeted towards Delmarva chicken farmers who had concerns about the reintroduction of a northern pint snake, a very large, impressive, really loud snake. We're going to refer to these examples throughout the presentation, and we're happy to elaborate more at the end of the hour in the open discussion. It is our experience that research truly is the foundation, the building block on which strategic community development is done. And we've seen this happen in three crucial stages. First, community research helps us establish what those needs are in our community and to prioritize those needs. If that's not enough, this type of needs assessment service is often a requirement for funding agencies, so it simply must be done. Once we've done research to establish the needs, the research is then used to help create and implement programs that are utilized and efficient. For example, in the pine snake study, it wasn't appropriate for us to apply that work to the entire community who would probably never come in contact with the snake, but it was appropriate to focus that particular study on farmers who probably would, and our hope was certainly that they wouldn't kill it when they saw it. Once that phase is done, research is used as well to help further improve projects as we go, ongoing, coming up with newer and better ideas to help serve our community. We think especially in these tough economic times where every single dollar is crucial, that research really must work with the community to build programs that truly are essential and will be used by the population. However, the problem is that service organizations, government agencies, small local businesses may have little time, money, and personnel resources available to be able to do this. So if you consider the time restraints on someone in a local organization, their mission is certainly to serve their clients, not to conduct extensive research projects. Likewise, there are probably limited funds. Those funds have to go to the most pressing projects. They're not necessarily going to be earmarked for research equipment and materials. And then personnel themselves may have not had the opportunity for statistical and methodological training, and their heart and passion might lie elsewhere in the organization, not conducting research, as hard as that might be to believe that that wouldn't be somebody's passion. So that's where we as academics come in. We have a wealth of different things that we can offer. So first, we have graduate training, and so we come with a skill set that can be really useful to these organizations. We are so fortunate to have access to things that not everybody has access to. We can access empirical databases, we have statistical packages, we have software and other things at our disposal. We are also fortunate enough to have a research and grants office that can help us find and secure funding for these projects. We have over 8,000 wonderful students that can collaborate on these projects with us as they get hands-on experience that they can apply after graduation. And most abstractly, but perhaps most importantly, we have a social responsibility as academics and researchers that are actually living in a community to take our work and ground it in our very own neighborhoods. So therefore, we believe that these partnerships benefit all stakeholders. Most obviously, the organizations and their clients will benefit, but we see this as a win-win for everybody. We get to strengthen the town-gown relationship, which is sometimes strained. As such, the university can grow deeper roots into the community. As researchers, we get to see our hard work not applied elsewhere in some ethereal universe, but in our own backyards and neighborhoods and town. The nature of this work is that it tends to be interdisciplinary, as Michelle mentioned. The Wicomico partnership involved PACE, social work, psychology, and communications faculty and students. This type of work also tends to be long-term. That particular project started in the summer of 2012, and it's continuing with a different faculty member right now with her students conducting grant research for that organization. And as I mentioned, our students benefit so much from having this type of real-life experiential research to get them excited about doing this outside of the classroom.
So I want to talk a little bit, and round out our time today, by talking about how you do this type of research and some of the ways that it differs from doing more basic university-focused laboratory research. And I want you to also to keep in mind that when you're doing this research, it's really important to do so from a social justice perspective, which is the perspective that we've adopted. A social justice focus focuses primarily on ensuring equality for people who are involved with or who are affected by the research outcomes. Keep in mind, there is an unfortunate historical legacy of faculty at various universities, not Salisbury, because we're wonderful, but at other types of universities, swooping into community settings, collecting data, and then running away with that data without actually translating it back into any kind of community change or social action. And we would argue that this is actually not the approach we want to take. So if we want to work on projects with community members, we want to make sure that we're working collaboratively and that we're actually translating those research findings back into some usable form for the community, that we're actually offering some type of benefit. And obviously, this social justice perspective, this framework, results in some really key differences between laboratory-based research and applied research. And I want to just talk about four of the key differences. So the first one I already mentioned is that it's inherently equality-based. Research, in our perspective, should be primarily driven by organizational and community needs. And that isn't to say that as university-based researchers that we can't work on things that are interesting to us or that we can't apply theories that we work on to our research. And we definitely can and we definitely should. But at the same time, ignoring community needs, ignoring organizational needs is going to do a disservice ultimately to our community and therefore to ourselves because we live here too. So our focus should really be primarily on building the community and in building capacity building, okay, making sure that research is actually translated back into social action and change. The equality focus also means that how you enter into these types of partnerships is really important. It's our perspective that these relationships with community members should be very carefully cultivated, and that's one thing that we definitely try to do. So when we're meeting with people out in the community to work on research projects, we don't come in with our expert hat on, but rather as somebody who's there to work collaboratively and to assist with what they need, okay, with what they need. Because it is equality focused, it's also inherently participatory, okay? So if it's going to be equitable, we have to allow various stakeholders involved to participate. Now, who do I mean by a stakeholder? This might be organizational staff. This might be participants in our research. This might be politicians, funders, people who are in some way invested in the research process and outcomes. So you're working to solve a social problem. There are a lot of people who are also interested in addressing that need too, right? And we have to involve the input from these various stakeholders in designing and executing our research. Now, this isn't necessarily a barrier, or I don't want people to get the impression that this is a hurdle that needs to be crossed, because in many ways, involving multiple stakeholders in the design of your research project is actually going to enhance it, okay? And let me give you an example of that. So when I worked on the Core Service Agency project, I was charged with the task of interviewing key informants in the community, right? Well, who's most keyed in to identify those key informants? Well, not me, right? I don't really necessarily know because I don't work in the area of mental health, right? I don't work with foster care kids. My partnering agency did. So I relied very heavily on them to assist me in identifying who would be appropriate people that would be most informative to meet the research goals, okay? So that wouldn't have been possible, obviously, if you don't make it a participatory project. A third key difference is that of adaptability. Community-based research has to, by its very nature, be flexible and be adaptable. Community organizations don't work necessarily on a semester timeline, so we like to keep things within a semester, but real-world problems, social issues, they don't work that way, right? So we have to be adaptable. There's also, as Chris mentioned, maybe financial or logistical limitations that require some creativity. And this might mean that you have to be kind of innovative in how you approach projects. So I'll give you an example of that. So on the Wicomico Partnership project, we were doing surveys, and we initially started with telephone surveys. And pretty soon in, we realized that we weren't really getting the numbers that we needed, right? We needed to increase our sample size. So we had to make an adaption. We ended up supplementing that with doing in-person data collection at the Salisbury Festival. We'll be doing a couple more in-person data collection at a couple faith-based organizations in Salisbury. And that's kind of messy, right? It's kind of messy, it's kind of sticky. Now we have data that's collected from multiple locations at multiple different points in time in multiple modalities, right? And it's a statistical nightmare, right? So, but luckily, you know, I'm qualified to do those statistics for them, right? But if we had not been willing to be adaptable and flexible, well, the project wouldn't have gotten done, right? We wouldn't have gotten done. And that has significant negative implications for our community, right? So now we've left the partnership in a hole. They wouldn't have been able to develop a strategic plan. Funding for agencies would have been impacted, right? So you have to be necessarily adaptable. And the last key difference I want to talk about today is just that of ownership. And as university faculty, we're often very used to having primary or even sole ownership over the data, over the outcomes, over how and where that those findings get presented and published. And when you're doing community-based research, well, keep in mind, researchers might not own the research outcomes. The information might be proprietary. It might be sensitive. It might not necessarily be publishable in those traditional modalities. Okay, so just keep that in mind. My recommendation would be that if authorship is important to you, and it is obviously for faculty on some of our projects, that you just work out those authorship arrangements in advance. So by drafting an MOU and making sure that everyone's interest and role is explicitly laid out at the start of the project. So hopefully we have demonstrated to you the benefits of engaging in community-based research, showed you some of the differences between this type of research and more basic research processes. And we just want to conclude with just an encouragement and a call to action to really build successful community university research partnerships. And I want to again just end by reflecting on our university motto and challenge us all to learn about ourselves, our community, and how we can work together to meet community needs, to truly live as community-based scholars, and to become leaders in our community, cultivate leadership in others, and work together to link research with action and community change. And we just like to point out our various collaborators who've assisted on some of the projects we talked about, the students who've served as research assistants from the various classes we've taught, and of course, the community members who took part. Thank you.
So, first up to bat for the 2 o'clock session is Dr. Jim Forte, Professor of Social Work.
Good afternoon. As you heard, I'm Jim Forte, Professor in the Great Department of Social Work. And today I'm going to talk about my study about the love-hate relationship between social work and scientific theory. I'll also preview my scholarship identifying some strategies to repair this damaged relationship. I'll refer at times to my own life history to illustrate this development of my interest in theory. Also, I'm going to attempt to answer the question asked by many friends and colleagues and my dean, what did I do during my sabbatical? First, though, forgive me, I misunderstood. I thought that we were expected to model our presentations on Mr. Ed talks. I watched every episode of Mr. Ed that I could. And this morning my wife told me it was TED talks, not Mr. Ed talks.
Hello, I'm Mr. Ed.
So I'm going to have to do the best I can under these circumstances. Oh, I want to thank Clifton and Graduate Studies for the faculty mini-grant and Salisbury University for the sabbatical leave. They provided me the time and energy to pursue my scholarship, something I can't do as well when I don't have that time. Oops, how'd those slides get there? That's not what I did during my sabbatical. And thanks to the other supporters of my work, especially on the left, those are my homies with the baccalaureate program directors group and the recent and former chairperson. They have large entourages. The entourages are following them there on the right. And I appreciate all the work the librarians did. The Council on Social Work Education, that's the accrediting body for social work. And they are mandating that social work education programs help prepare students so they can demonstrate 10 competencies in the form of a whole range of practice behaviors. And I believe that scientific theories and theorizing skills will help students climb this pinnacle towards achievement of those competencies. They probably see this Mayan temple as bringing them up to human sacrifice, but I'm trying to convince them otherwise. I'm also starting from the position, the pragmatist position, that theories are tools. And social workers need a wide range of tools in a big toolbox if they're going to face and meet all the challenges that they need to meet. Just to give you, to orient you to my thinking of theory, I'll talk a little bit about some of the major functions and illustrate them as I've come to use them in my own life. First, theory helps us describe and answer questions such as what's going on here and who is that wild kid at the end of that couch. Theory helps us categorize and ask questions like, how am I supposed to put this stuff in the right piles? These are not the questions I help social work students learn, but give you the idea. Theory helps us predict, forecast future patterns. Based on our current knowledge, it might help us answer an eighth grader's question, what's next, and will my rank in the school system always be number two? Fourth, theory helps us explain behavioral and social puzzles. This is a X-rated one, sorry. Such as, why do those large people keep pointing that thing and flashing the light when my clothes are off? Fifth, and very importantly for practitioners, theory helps guide action, helping us figure out what to do, how to assess, how to intervene. For example, for the young painter in this slide, theory could indicate that the paint should go on the wall, but this artist is having a tough time figuring out where the wall is. Finally, scientific theory helps us communicate. It helps facilitate quick and precise use of language. Here's just one little illustration. If I learn baby talk, will I have more fun? So I had a hunch based on my practice experiences, discussion with students, presentations at the local, regional, and national conferences, that social workers are not very fond of theory. Even though we consider theory practice integration one of our favorite terms. So with the support of the faculty grant and the sabbatical, I've been able to study that a little bit, and I'm just going to briefly review. I'm deciding whether social workers have a love stance. That's the image on the left, couple harmoniously sitting on a table, or they have a hate stand. This actually isn't the image for hate. My grandmother would want me to show you that. This is the image for indifference. I looked at a variety of resources that document our profession's identity and mission. And the main point I'm making here is that when we categorize those, many in the mixed, the largest number in the indifferent or hate. So the question, does our profession affirm the value of theory or show indifference or hate, at least based on all these various sources, classic statements, mission statements, our resources, our library of resources, our professional sections, I conclude, tends toward neglect or hate. A second part of this, I took a look at 31 studies. Same question. Each of the studies examined the degree to which practitioners and other social workers made use of theory, could articulate the theoretical knowledge that was guiding them. The 12 quantitative studies, 15 qualitative, 4 mixed, 1931 to 2013 across 5 different countries using a variety of methods. And you see here even a more dramatic portrait of indifference or antipathy. So when we count and do the grand tally, 14, some of the studies had more than one finding, 14 statements of hate, 16 mixed, 4 love. Ideally, from my point of view, social workers would marry theorists. They would see the value of a reciprocal and caring partnership between theory and practice. Theory would inform practice, and practice would inform theory. However, most commonly, I'm concluding based on those two different tables, social workers are giving this called the four-finger purse sign. Che cavolo dici. What the heck are you asking me to do with this? And in some cases, they're giving theory the chin flick sign. That's non mi frega, Back off, I don't give a damn about your stinking theory. Why might this be? I think it's unfortunate. Hopefully we can change this. Based on what I've read, I see two major explanations. Many practitioners and others don't think theory makes sense, scientific theory makes sense, and think it's useless. First, they don't see it as making sense. Theory is presented as a language, but a language that's full of jargon, odd grammatical and rhetorical conventions, and translation seems very, very hard. I'm going to read you an example. There'll be a test afterwards during our break, and we'll see who can actually translate this. This comes from Ludwig von Bertalanffy speaking about systems theory. Just shared this with my students. A consequence of the existence of general system properties and the appearance of structural similarities or isomorphism or isomorphisms in different fields. There are correspondences in the principles that govern the behavior of entities that are intrinsically widely different. Got that? False. Ernest Greenwood, an expert on the profession of social work, agrees. This is a tough thing for many social workers, having a hard time translating the language that's used by academic theorists as they write and publish their theoretical thinking. Second, theory as generated in the academy is often not seen as useful. Social workers consider it too abstract, stated in formal terms instead of the kind of narratives we like. And it's hard for them to imagine how they would actually use this knowledge to solve problems that they're facing in everyday practice. So what are we going to do? I'm also previewing a couple of repair strategies. Assuming that this relationship is damaged, how could we start to repair it? Thomas Kuhn, a philosopher of science, thought translation is needed between those who are making use of different paradigms or theoretical traditions. In my first one of the books that I finished over sabbatical, focusing on multi-theoretical social work, I identified seven different tools that students and novice social workers could use to start translating this complex theory into language they could understand and grasp. I'm not going to go into those, but I've been trying this out with a colleague on the planet Triskelion, and these universal translation devices have been working very well for me anyway. We'll see how they do. And the students seem to be responding. Second strategy, they need tools to transform theoretical knowledge from the way it's presented by academics, typically by us in college, into forms that are useful. I think of this in terms of learning a whole variety of skills for deconstructing and reconstructing theory and practicing those skills over and over and over again. An ethnographer, Chambliss, studied some of the great swimmers of all time, and he discovered many had great genetic dispositions and some of the physical attributes, but the main thing is they mastered a set of skills that they did over and over and over again until they had this holistic approach to swimming that made them champions. So the second book I finished up focused on practical theorizing, identifies 21 different theorizing skills and helps the readers learn how to use those to actually deconstruct or take apart theory and the elements and then to reconstruct it for use in a variety of practical situations. I've been using these theorizing skills. I think I'm getting in good shape and I hope to win an award soon in my own swimming competitions. You're seeing some first-rate Photoshop work here, by the way. So let me conclude. I believe in the possibility of reconciliation. Social workers can change their emotions of ambivalence, indifference, and hate into those of love. We can move from polarities to unity. You may know the great philosopher Yogi Berra. He said he summarized the position of polarity. In theory, there's no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. There's a constant struggle between theory and practice. I like baseball. I even once hit a triple for Hometown Laundry in the playoffs. However, Yogi Berra's emphasis on differences won't lead to a happy union or relationship between theorists and practitioners. I turn instead to Jane Addams. She's my number one role model. You don't have to read this whole thing. I'll briefly summarize it. I often ask WWJD, what would Jane Addams do? She would call for us to translate knowledge for practical use in ameliorating problems and helping those with the most needs and advancing democracy. So I'm going to carry on Jane Addams' work and try to be a matchmaker and marital counselor and spread the news to my students, colleagues, and profession. Here's my message: theory is useful. Theoretical knowledge and theorizing are very relevant to social work and to plan change projects. Mastery of theory and theorizing skills will ease the ascent to the peak of professional excellence. I'm hoping that my students and those that like this message will try a different gesture. This is the kiss gesture of love. Thanks to my supporters, I'm very fortunate to get some forewords written by some really good theoretical thinkers in social work. Thanks to the family. And for those of you who want more to read, first book's coming out in January. That's helping readers translate theory for use. In negotiations now, we're hoping Bruce Willis will star in the movie version as me, and Susan Sarandon's going to play my wife. The second book should be out in February. This provides lessons in using these theorizing skills. It looks like John Malkovich will be my part, and Helen Mirren may play my wife. In case you came in late, my name is Forte, James Forte. Thank you.
We have Dr. Arthur Limbo, Associate Professor.
Hi. Thanks. Like Clifton said, my name is Art Limbo. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Geography and Geosciences here at Salisbury University. I'm also the technical director of the Eastern Shore Regional GIS Cooperative. We'll talk a little bit about that. And I was asked to talk about this idea of how we engage undergraduates in both theoretical and applied GI science. I guess the story starts, though, before I came here. I was in a discussion with a vice president of a major research university who was talking to me about how they were revamping a lot of their undergraduate education to give their students, their undergraduate students at least, a better undergraduate experience. But he ended the conversation by saying, but let's face it, we're never going to be Swarthmore. Now, that's a little bit of inside baseball for some of our visitors here. What that really means is Swarthmore is the gold standard for undergraduate education. I mean, they were doing everything right, and that's what a lot of people want to do, that kind of a program. Now, I contrast that with, as I came here to interview, I met Tom Jones, who at one time was the provost here at Salisbury University, and he said, look, if you're an 18-year-old kid and you come to Salisbury University, you're going to be in the lab with a professor with a PhD. And I thought, wow, this guy gets it. I mean, he totally gets the idea that we can give our undergraduates a really special undergraduate experience, not just in the classroom and lectures, but in the laboratories. We don't have to settle for having our students go to small little undergraduate conferences. No, we can send them to our conferences, our discipline conferences, our international, our national conferences. We don't have to settle for giving them class assignment papers to write. No, they can engage in research with us in the lab so that when they graduate, they have a peer-reviewed publication for when they go to graduate school. And no, they don't have to work on small class projects. No, instead, they can work with us on real-world projects that affect people all around us. So I want to focus on some of the theoretical or the classical research that we do, as well as some of the applied work. So here we are talking from hours to seconds, massively parallel processing with inexpensive video gaming cards and geographic information science. Now, how many people play video games? Okay, you do. I don't really play video games. I'm not very good at them. But I am fascinated with the transformation that's happening in computing due to the video game communities. They are fundamentally changing how we perform computing in a modern world. Now, like I said, I'm a geographer, so I work with data, things that relate to the Earth's surfaces. And I work with data types that are called terrains or models of what the Earth looks like. I can figure out and use write programs that help me figure out how tall things are, what direction they're facing, how steep the slope is, and that helps me figure out, are there areas that are susceptible for landslides or for soil loss or for a rock fall or debris flow, or are there other areas, how at risk is a community due to runoff, or are there certain locations that are a better ecosystem for a particular species? So I write these kinds of algorithms to do these sorts of things. I have to work with really enormous data types, something like this. The Chesapeake Bay watershed has billions and billions of data elements related to terrains. So for me to figure out what direction the land flows, I have to write things of the order of magnitude of a tenth or a quarter of a trillion operations that have to be run computationally. So I need computer manufacturing and the whole computer world to transform itself to help me do this, because computers are not fast enough to do it. But here's the problem. Like I said, I'm a geographer. Nobody cares what I think or what I want, right? Yeah, thank you. But we asked about video games before. You all heard about Grand Theft Auto. What happened this last, about 2 weeks ago when Grand Theft Auto came out? Anybody remember, know how much money they made day one? Yeah. $1 billion. Yep, $800 million. People care what these guys think. And they do the same kinds of things with terrains that I do. They have to perform billions and billions of computations. So what they've done is they went to the hardware manufacturers and said, you got to do something about it. Well, companies like NVIDIA develop video cards, and a lot of you have heard of things like dual-core computers, quad-core computers. Well, what the video game manufacturers have done is they've built cards and put graphical processing units on them. This card is a cheap one. It's got 96 processors on it. Don Spickler wouldn't let me take the real ones out that we use. The ones we have in our lab have 1,000 processors. This isn't a fast computer any longer. This has architecturally changed how we do computing. This is a massively parallel supercomputer, and you buy them at Walmart, because if little Johnny wants to shoot things in Grand Theft Auto, he wants the fastest game available, and for under $1,000, you can pick this up. So these kids playing games have massively parallel supercomputers at their disposal. So I thought, why do the gamers have all the fun? Why don't we try to reimagine the things that we're doing architecturally with the kinds of algorithms we run with terrains? So what we did was we brought some undergraduates in who had interest in geography and computer science, and we said, let's take these cards that may have 1,000 processors on them and take a terrain like this and send all the different operational elements all over this card and simultaneously perform thousands of computations. So this is a short little video I made. It's only about 14 seconds long, but it shows you how we generate slope for a terrain surface in a traditional way. And then the video is going to end showing you how we do it when we take advantage of the parallel processing capabilities of a card like this. So you can see I'm pressing the OK button. So here we're evaluating all the pixels. And we're done. Here's what happens with parallel processing. Hit the OK button, we're done. Okay? That's the power of sending all these different data elements to a card like this to simultaneously perform all the computations. Gotta find my, here it is. So we, with our undergraduates, as we worked on this, we decided to look at how we can, how we can better improve this. Now, this is a little bit of techie talk here. Basically, we're taking a really large file, we're reading it into the computer, then we're taking pieces of that file and putting it on the card. This card doesn't have a lot of memory, so we have to get little pieces in and out. And this is where all kind of the magic is performed in the graphical processing unit. And then we write the whole thing out. What we found was, it was real fast, like you saw, but we thought we can hopefully make it faster. And we began identifying some bottlenecks. For instance, when all the magic's happening here, the rest of the computer was, well, sort of asleep. We thought, well, we know about multi-threading computers. You've heard that term. So how about, while we're running this, let's open up another thread and keep bringing more data in. And as we're writing things out, let's keep bringing more data in. So we started to make use of the architecture of the computer. If you notice, we're not talking about terrains anymore. We're not talking about geography. Now we're getting into computer architecture and how we overcome some of the bottlenecks that are inherent in computing systems. These are some of the results we found. Again, we'll just spend a couple of seconds on it. This is, again, this is where all the magic happens on the GPU. Look at the time. This is what it takes. We're using Queen Anne's County, which has about a billion data elements to compute slope with. Here's our input, how we process, the output time, and then the total time. We're way faster here. But notice this. Right? This is where the magic happens. The GPU is happening pretty much zero. It's not going to get much faster than this. I mean, we're at a couple billions of processes happening in about 4 seconds. I don't care how many processors we put on this thing. That's about as fast as it gets. We're saturating this card so well that we're getting the kind of results that we really want. This is the bottleneck. This is that architectural problem. So our students started thinking about, well, how do we overcome this? And that's where we got into some of the multi-threading capabilities to say, how do we begin to whittle this down? And where we're at right now is our input time is about as fast as an operating system copy, which means you're not going to get data in any faster than this. So what's really cool about the work we've been doing the past 2 summers is we are hitting the edge or the limits of the kinds of processing we can do in parallel processing, because this isn't going to get any faster. We're already about the same speed that it takes to just copy a file, let alone read it in. So this is really cool research in geographic sciences, that we're hitting the edge for what can we expect to get out of these processes. But it got us to think a little bit more about different ways we could read the data in, whether it's one stream or in what we call different chunking. So we've tried that, but we're about as fast as we're going to get. So one of our students that I worked with this past summer thought, well, what if we reimagine the project a different way? See, what we do with terrains is I have a lot of data and a few computations for each data element. What he thought was, well, what if we take smaller amounts of data? And normally, to figure out the elevation of this center point over here, we look at the 8 surrounding areas and we figure it out. We could do it at the 25, or 49, or 81. This takes 81 calculations. This takes 802. So we thought, well, if we get the data on the card, let's just beat it to death with as many kinds of computations as we can. So it's now taking small amounts of data with massive amounts of processes, which eliminate the input time. So we now have, but it's reimagining a different kind of a problem. Well, we ran that, and this is what we found. Instead of being 4 or 5 times faster, we're 100 or 60 times faster. So get your head around that. That means something that takes about 3 days to accomplish, we're completing in about an hour, because all the work is happening on the GPU. Are already showing that this happens virtually instantaneous when you have 1,000 of these things firing off at once. So what we're trying to do next, or where we're working, where we're moving next, is let's identify those kinds of geographic problems that lend themselves to data coming in, being put on the card, and running over and over again. These are simulations. So we can run simulation models for market penetration or other kinds of geographic analysis. So that's kind of the direction we're going in with some of our classical research. But we're also giving our students, again, taking Tom Jones's idea, a different kind of an experience working in the lab with us on real-world problems. Now, a lot of you may not know, but on the edge of campus, right next to our practice field, is a small building called the Eastern Shore Regional GIS Cooperative. I feel like Mark Rubio. I'm going to have to take a drink of water. Hopefully it was a little bit smoother, right? This is an outreach and extension organization from the geography department where we perform applied geographic research. We have 14 full-time employees. Every single one of them is a Salisbury University undergraduate or alumni. They come from different departments, computer science and geography. We do about $250,000 to $500,000 a year in sponsored research. And it gives us an opportunity to take our undergraduates, have them work alongside our professional staff on real-world projects. There we go. And we're working on real things. These are not class projects. These are things that take on the state of Maryland's masthead. This is something our students have worked on with the Maryland critical area. Our undergraduates worked alongside of our professional staff and created all the maps for the critical area, and then working with our professional staff, our computer science majors are now building the web applications that Maryland likes so much, they said, we're going to drop it right in our masthead. So this is a real project. This is not some kind of a class project. We are now working along with Beacon with this concept of dashboarding or geo-dashboarding. Now, dashboards are used a lot in business for getting critical information. I'm going to skip past this slide and just do a little bit of dancing on my toes. Here's one of the dashboards that shows for labor licensing and regulation. And we can look at job seekers in the state. Let's do it by county. So we can see the different job seekers that are in the state and where different counties relate to it and what their occupation group is. We can click on Wicomico County. We can see where we fall. But with Wicomico County, we can also see what kind of occupation groups are they looking for. We can do it for different regions as well. Here's another example of county comparison. So again, our students have developed this. Our computer science students have worked with our professional staff, and here we're looking at comparing a bunch of different states in the region. So again, it's intelligence dashboarding along with a geographic example. So that's why we call it geo-dashboarding. So we can look at education levels, and we can look at the different states. We want to throw New York in there as well. There it pops in. And we can compare each of these different organizations or each of these different states with one another. Here's another one for Caroline County, emergency services. So I can look at individual locations and find out information about the calls for each of those and begin to look at response times. You can see those colored in or priority levels. These are all built by our staff that were SU graduates in the ESRGC working alongside our undergraduates. What the term Mike and I like to use is we say we eat our own dog food in the sense that we get our students working in the ESRGC, those who are really good, we hire, and then we expand the influence of what we're doing. So these are the kinds of experiences that we want to give our undergraduates. This is another one. Again, another Maryland masthead, Baystat. How is the health of the Bay doing? We built that. Our students built that. Our undergraduates built that. So again, we're putting them not in small stake projects. These are big stakes, right? This is real world stuff. This is stuff that says, oh, don't worry if it doesn't work well. Our undergraduates are put in a professional environment where they have to perform. And that kind of leads me to one of the things that's happened. Next slide. Oh, a couple other applications, I'm sorry. I see Josh is here too, one of our undergraduates who's been building smartphone device applications. This is one we did for the Nature Conservancy. And again, we make use of location services on the phone, and then they're able to give virtual tours. This one, though, on the right is really interesting. This is used by gas inspectors. When they're out in the field, if they smell gas, they can pop open their phone, use the location device, and it tells them what the indications of a leak are, and it also tells them what's underneath their feet, which gas company has lines under there, what they're carrying, and then what are the emergency and contact numbers. This is like real stuff, right? This isn't play. And this is what undergraduates are working on alongside our regular paid staff at the ESRGC. So this kind of gets back to this last slide. Talks, I think, says it all in terms of what we're doing with our undergraduates. Remember last year, coming up on the anniversary of Superstorm Sandy. That hit, and a few years ago, we had donated the time of a number of our geography students to perform damage assessment for the earthquake in Haiti. This year, we didn't pick up the telephone. The phone called us, and organizations working for FEMA said, we need people to immediately jump on damage assessment. Here's what an area looked like before the storm. Here's what it looks like after the storm. They needed to find throughout the entire eastern seaboard what was the impact and scope of Superstorm Sandy. So we got 50 students, all paid, working on it in a professional environment. We had to stand the entire thing up in about a day or two. But by the way, this is also in your research magazine, which you got as you came in here. But I want to point your attention to this picture that's also in here of Michelle. She's got a name tag on. She's like, why does she need a name tag? Because hurricanes never happen when you want them to. We were organizing a professional conference here at campus. The Pennsylvania Geographic Society was here. Why the Pennsylvania Geographic Society is having their conference in Maryland, that's another question. But Michelle was presenting her work that she's been working on with tornadoes at that conference that morning. So she goes to the conference, professional conference, gives her paper, and then she hightails it back to our lab to work on the damage assessment, because that's the expectation we hold for them, that we expect our students to perform at a level that rivals a professional organization. By the way, when she's done here, she hightails it back to the next place. She also presented her work at a national conference. She's now got a full ride at Alabama in graduate school. That's what we expect for our students, to engage in meaningful, real-world work so they can start to have a better future for themselves. So I guess, as I look at this, I conclude by maybe modifying Tom Jones' statement a little bit and saying, if you're an undergraduate and you come to Salisbury University as a geography major, you're going to be in the lab with a professor, with a PhD, and you're going to engage in meaningful research on real-world projects that where the expectations are that you're going to be as good as any professional that's out there. So for the faculty here, I would say, don't let anybody tell you you can't be Swarthmore. You can walk into your classroom and say, you know what, I can give my undergraduate students the absolute best experience out of any college in America. And if you could see what our 50 students did here at a moment's notice, you'll realize our students are up for the challenges too. So really what it takes is for you to just dive in head first and just give it all you got, because it is just so exciting to see the kinds of things these students are doing as they engage in this real world and theoretical research. So thank you.
You have been listening to a selection of recordings from Salisbury University's Research Day and Innovation Showcase. These recordings were made on Friday, September 27, 2013, on the campus of Salisbury University. For more information, visit salisbury.edu/researchday. You're listening to Delmarva Public Radio. You have been listening to Salisbury University's inaugural Research Day and Innovation Showcase, recorded Friday, September 27, 2013. For more information, visit salisbury.edu/researchday.